Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. Hello, and welcome to Dig This Environmental Watch. I'm Pamela Spoto, host of this show. In the studio today, I am joined by Craig Boyer, MSW, Randy Compton, longtime resident of Round Mountain and researcher on climate change, and he's also a former logger, and Dr. Jim Collins, ecopsychologist. Hello to you all.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
We have come together today for a roundtable discussion. And the discussion we're going to have is on the topic of community, eco-villages, food security, and self-reliance in the era of climate change. This seems like a lot, and it is a lot, but it all relates. Each one of these items relates to another. This discussion is going to be academic and intellectual, as well as including hands-on experiences. We do believe in science here and education as well. In order to talk about our topics for today, we need to begin with looking at the way we think, the way we perceive the world. Unless our thinking and perceptions change, we can't expect change in the world or in the community in which we live. And many authors talk about this, and we're going to be talking about four books as well, or just mentioning four books as well. And without this shift in thinking, we will continue business as usual, which means continued environmental degradations, systems collapsing, for example, oceans, species extinction, aquifer toxicity, the list goes on. Without facing and taking action on climate change, we will continue to have bigger and hotter fires, more droughts, worsened storms such as hurricanes and cyclones, floods, and so forth. And I would also like to mention these four books. As I mentioned, we are going to be relating the topic to some of these books. One is David Corton, The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community. Ralph Metzner, Green Psychology. Vandana Shiva, Earth Democracy, and she's written many, many different books. Bruce Lipton, The Biology of Belief. In order to face climate change, as I said, we do need to take action, and writers that are scientists, climatologists, environmentalists, spiritual activists, and even the Pope. The Pope has said that pollution is a sin. I really like this Pope. But these writers are also saying we need to make a shift in thinking, a shift in consciousness, a transformation in how we view the world, truly a paradigm shift. And what I would like to do is just take a few minutes to talk about what this shift might look like, and then we're going to have a discussion about this initially, and then we'll move on to community. So with David Corton in his book, From Empire to Earth Community, that's exactly what he's saying. Okay, we have empire, and how do we transform this perception of empire, this living of empire? And I think we would agree that if we're fighting endless wars around the world, we are engaging in empire building. I mean, it seems to me that is true. To transform from that perspective to Earth Community. And Corton suggests that in empire, we would believe life is hostile and competitive. Humans are flawed and dangerous. We have order by dominator hierarchy. We compete or die, and we love power. And he's suggesting that we move into Earth Community values, which would mean life is supportive and cooperative. Humans have many possibilities. We have order through partnership. We cooperate and live, and we love life rather than power. And Metzger in Green Psychology continues this idea of a shift in values and perceptions. He calls it moving from the industrial to the ecological. And I have a whole list of ideas that he has, and I'm not going to read this whole list, but it's kind of fascinating because under industrial, for example, he has the role of the human being. And he sees that as the conquest of nature, heroic individualism, and exploitation. But if you have an ecological worldview, you might be seeing living as part of nature, having an ecological consciousness. And instead of exploitation, you would be involved in restoration. And then the idea of human social interactions in an industrial society, he is suggesting that it is sexist and patriarchal. And I wonder, do you think that we have that today? I mean, as we look around, when I listen to the news, you know, all of these things that are happening with men in power and the idea of it's okay to grab them, you know, as people have said, and others that are also heads of news networks, for example. It's not just in our presidency. And racism and ethnocentrism. And so Metzger believes that we move from that to more of a feminist meaning, to me, embodying feminine values of nurturing, for example, partnership, multiculturalism, and diversity. And I'm going to skip down to economic systems. Metzner says that in our current economic system, it is competitive. We have multinational corporation. We have the idea of limitless economic growth. And this is what I don't understand, especially when we have a planet that is finite, to believe we can have we could have unlimited growth. It doesn't make sense. So to move to the ecological worldview, of cooperation and competition, community-based economies, limits to growth. And then finally, in terms of technology, right now we seem to be living in, and I wouldn't even say seem, we are living in an era of addiction to fossil fuels, waste overload, we throw tons of stuff away, exploitation and consumerism, versus, you know, recycling, reusing, renewables, protecting and restoring ecosystems. So that is kind of where I would like to begin our discussion this morning, is that what about this shift? What about this shift in thinking and the way we perceive the world? Is it even possible? Has it begun? What do you think?
I think that someone like Elon Musk has gotten ideas about, you know, using solar, for example, in Puerto Rico.
Yes.
And whereas Ryan Zinke's buddies are Whitefish Energy or something like that, they
Whitefish,
are
Whitefish, yes.
Yes, and they are looking to continue the fossil fuel usage and continue the exploitation there and putting that stuff into the atmosphere, creating more global warming. So we have, on the one hand, Elon Musk, who's doing something real positive here. Now, who's going to win? In this administration that we're in, it certainly looks like the Ryan Zinke, Donald Trump factor is going to win for Puerto Rico. But we can hope that that's somehow overturned.
And were you at the Terry Tempest Williams lecture?
No, I wasn't.
I thought somebody said that they saw you, Craig. And it's very interesting because Zinke was brought up during that discussion, and he was saying that he was suggesting that we go into all of our national parks, or out of six we'd let stay the way they are, and another 21 we would go in and we would drill and we would frack and we would mine. And so what you're saying is exactly true. So Puerto Rico is still suffering. I think 80% of the power is still out in Puerto Rico. But it's, how do you pronounce his name? Elon Musk. Is down there with solar, right? Mm-hmm. And putting in solar panels to run hospitals, for example. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. He just took it upon himself to do that. Okay? And so what you're suggesting is that, you know, who's going to win here? Is it going to be green energy, clean energy? Or are we going to continue just devastating the earth through trying to get that last little bit
of fracking it out of the earth
and creating earthquakes and destroying aquifers along the way? So, Jim Collins, what do you think in terms of this shift of consciousness?
Well, I think from what you're just saying about the political system, what we're dealing with right now with the corporate model, the industrialized political system, and it seems like we're doubling down on what's not working. And what not only is not working, but is a folly of artificial adaptation as opposed to natural adaptation, which is, it's folly because it doesn't follow what nature sets as the parameters for us. And so we're talking about ecology and ecological consciousness that we don't think about our role in and our relationship with and how that all works together as one big whole. We want to isolate and we want to focus on artificial adaptations that really don't work in the long run. They may work for a specific issue to solve a problem in the short term, but those create bigger problems by the ramifications because they're not considering the connectedness and the relationship between all things. And so I see this as one of the biggest juxtapositions here is between competition and cooperation. Competition is a me thing. And cooperation is an us thing, a we thing. And as long as we continue to think in that way, and as long as that is the basis of our political and economic ideas, we'll continue to be stuck there. I don't see us going that direction. But on the other hand, I think that things are getting so bizarre that people are starting to wake up and go, wait a minute, this is really screwy. What are we doing? You know, and I think I see a lot more of that individual lights going on and going, you know, this is not working. And so I kind of see that as being a necessary precursor to the change of consciousness we're talking about, that we need to recognize that what we've been doing over and over, it doesn't help to double down on something that doesn't work. Isn't that what Einstein said about insanity? You know, so you know, trying the same thing over and over again and expecting different results.
Yes. So that is an interesting point as well. And Randy, I'd like to ask you this question. And right before this show, we were talking about solar panels and water. I mean, so right now you are indeed living in this shift of thinking. Could you talk a little bit more about, I mean, if you want to talk a little bit more about that, I was really impressed. So you're going to have a solar hot water heater that heats your house, for example. I mean, we can make these steps rather than running on fossil fuels, for example.
Well, I think we have the technology to live on this planet and in a comfortable manner, in a comfortable, creative, productive manner. Without destroying the world around us, and we have to start from the basic, most fundamental fact that we are living on the only planet that we know of that has life, and we are existing as the product of a biosphere, which is like a coat of paint on a basketball, is very thin and fragile, and we are mindlessly consuming that as if we're going to somehow be powerful enough to find a way to exist with a broken biosphere that's falling apart all around us. So every little ways that we can struggle, we're caught in the middle of this. Now this has kind of come to my attention in the last part of my life of 60 years or 68 years. So now it's trying to find ways to live in harmony with our biosphere because we have no choice.
Absolutely.
And I had a student a few years ago. And he was really a smart, clever fellow. He was also a vet. And I remember him saying, you know, I really believe in technology, and I think we'll be able to travel to Mars and start cultivating Mars as a living planet. And I thought, how fascinating is that? You know, rather than, and I'm not putting him down by any means, but rather than, as suggested here, restoring the Earth that we have, as you were saying, Randy, it's the only one that we do have that has life on it, and taking care of that. Well, let me see. Maybe I can just go to Mars and establish this Mars colony. And he was talking about it'd be kind of exciting to have those little pellets that you eat, you know, be just a different lifestyle. And I'm just going, whoa, this is really, really very fascinating. So what I'm hearing here is that, you know, that we need to be taking care to be in right relationship with the world and the ecological systems around us to pick the best path in terms of energy that will be renewable and just becoming aware of where we live and taking care of what we need to take care of so that we can survive. Is there anything else that you want to that you want to talk about in terms of this shift of consciousness? I mean, I could say or I could ask, you know, is education going to be part of part in helping people think differently? Would you say that maybe establishing a parallel system in a way rather than, so, for example, we have solar panels on our house. We're not off-grid. I would like to be off-grid. So in a way, is it establishing a parallel way of living that is separate from fossil fuels and dirty energy to living a lifestyle of growing your own food, tending to the planet, having renewable resources? You know, I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Well, this whole notion of exploitation, I think that jumps right out at me, and what kind of Randy was hitting on as well. As long as we continue to exploit, thinking that there is not going to be any ramifications of that, that we can just exploit with unlimited growth forever and it'll be fine. So we're going to destroy the biosphere to extract from it. And then what? Go to Mars? I mean, come on. You know, Mars is, really? You know, we can't continue. It is just folly to think that we can have, there's no consequences to continue this attitude of exploitation, unlimited growth in a limited, on a limited planet. It just is, for me, I'm just flabbergasted that anybody would think that that makes any sense.
It's insane.
Absolutely.
Well, the business models, I mean, we have economists, right, that are supposedly well-educated, know what they're talking about growth and expansion and so forth. I mean, it just, for the common person, just to think about it, how far can you grow when you have a finite planet? It is not infinite. It is finite. You only have so much of it right here. And there's also the suggestion, it wasn't a suggestion, but in one of the environmental texts that I was reading, that if everyone in the world lived as an American does, we would need between 3 and 4 planets to support that way of life.
That says a lot.
It does. And it's the industrialized, the first world countries that are consuming the most and putting the most out there in terms of resource use. For example,
and destruction. Of the earth, really,
it right. is, and right. we're only 5% of the population. We use close to 30% of the world's resources.
And so we celebrate our lifestyle, our capitalistic exploitive lifestyle, as if that were the only way we can do it and the way it must be done. And so, talking about education, if people are raised with that idea, they get that in school, and then they go out into the world with that faulty model. And then they're just going to do more of the same thing. And so how do we correct that? For me, it's a folly. So I don't even think there's any benefit any longer to that, the old model. I think it has always been a folly. It didn't seem like such a folly when there were forests that stretched for thousands of miles and it seemed like we had plenty of everything, but we don't. Now we're seeing the results, and everywhere we see the results.
When we came over to the Europeans came over to this country, it was wide open, and they could exploit and exploit and exploit, and did, and created quite a empire. Well, that's starting to fall apart.
Yeah.
So we're not in the position to use up what we don't have anymore. We've used up what was here when we came.
And we have over 7 billion people in the world as it is now. And with that many people reproducing, doesn't take long to get another billion and another billion. So
there's an important point, Pamela. We need to have birth control.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, we do. Well, and to ignore that that is folly.
It is.
Well, somebody put up an idea the other day about it's not that we have limited resources. It's an issue of distribution, so that people are starving because they can't participate in the system. But you know, we were talking earlier on another note about before the show started about insects, and Randy was talking about the insects in Germany and the studies they've done about the depletion of the insect life down to 76% of it has been killed off, kind of like our seed stock, our seed biodiversity, and without insects, we're screwed. I mean, we think about the bees, and everybody's freaked out about the bees. I totally agree with that. But most of the pollination, for example, most of the health of the biosphere is accomplished by much smaller insects than that. The little no-see-ums and the bugs that get stuck to your windshield, they're absolutely essential to the biosystem. If we've lost that much of it already, how long does it take before we can't even live here anymore?
you know, the extraction, the technology of extraction has developed so rapidly in the last 100 years that it's sucking the resources of our planet like by the minute, and it's putting it, just turning it into cash in the pockets of a handful of the most wealthy individuals on the planet. And you can look at Google Earth of our area in Northern California, and you can see the vast clear cuts. Yes. Those clear cuts and them tree plantations have all pretty much developed in the last 25 years. That's happening globally. It's this machine that is reaching peak capacity to extract from the planet and turn it into personal profit for a few people.
Yes, that's right. And that's one of the reasons why I, as an introduction to you, Randy, is that you did work in logging and you know these things and you see these things and you've lived in the Round Mountain community basically all your life, have you not? And you've seen how the destruction of the surrounding forests has happened as well.
Well, yes, I have worked in the woods. I grew up in this, it was a logging community what I was born into here in Round Mountain. And there were sawmills everywhere, 10 of them, probably 10 sawmills within 5 miles. The whole community up here was full of sawmills, and it was all about timber. And in my lifetime, I've witnessed the eradication of these forest and ecosystems that will never be replaced. And it's gone into the pockets of just, again, a relatively few people who have become some of the most wealthy individuals on the planet at this time, when the same families that worked here have lived here in the logging industry are living in their same houses. So it's totally off balanced.
And this is a really, really important point. I just want to take a few more minutes to talk about this, because a lot of people will react to the logging and timber industry saying, well, you know, their management is fine, they go out and they replant. But they don't say it's often monocropping rather than diversity. And as we talked about in terms of people and seeds and crops, we need the diversity. And then the herbicides, I don't know if they use pesticides, but the herbicides that they do use kills other foliage within the area. The soil becomes problematic. The runoff goes into water, is contaminated. And then they don't want anybody coming onto their property and checking what the health of the stream is at that point, or the health of the soil. So it's not a pretty industry.
Well, by law, the timber industry gets to self-monitor their herbicide use. So and they use tons of herbicides. And again, anybody that has witnessed this firsthand like I have, and there are plenty of people around here who witnessed what we used to have like 50 years ago and what we don't have now.
Yes, yes. So I think that's a really important point as we go along to think about that. And that doesn't mean that we don't want people to have jobs. It's not the environment or jobs. It's the kinds of jobs. And With a correct administration who really champions green energy, ecological diversity, retraining people, people could have wonderful jobs that not only are good for the planet, but are good for their health. The whole notion of reactivating coal, for example, is one of the most insane, absurd things there is, because of the high contamination. I mean, people with black lung who work there, but the land is destroyed and they have these ash ponds and these ash stacks, all of cancer alleys surrounding this. So in terms of having that kind of work go by the wayside and retraining people in healthy jobs so the families can be healthy, the people can be healthy, they can make a good wage and also protect the earth. It's not an either or here. It's jobs or the economy. No, that's not what we're saying.
It's the kind of jobs.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, well,
yes.
You know, in the past, in our westward expansion of this country, one of the ways that agriculture was approached, and it worked then, was what we call slash and burn. People would move into an area, they'd burn down the forest or cut it down, burn everything up, and then they would plant and plant and plant until the land would no longer support that, until they couldn't grow anything anymore. They didn't realize that they had to keep putting it back, that it wasn't just an unlimited resource. We should have figured that out. It's been over 150 years since we figured that out, that we actually had to put fertilizer back in the ground or something. So rather than putting natural fertilizer, what would we use? Old munitions. So ammonium nitrates from explosives, from the wars, that we couldn't spend all that on killing people, so we decided to kill the earth instead. And so this faulty thinking once again raises its head, that we have our way of thinking about it is off balance, has never worked. And we should have learned these lessons a long time ago, but because certain people who have all the money are controlling, what's that, the golden rule? He who has the gold makes the rules. So here we are, continuing the same folly seemingly forever. So at what point do we realize that that isn't going to work for us? We have to do something else.
And that goes back to, I don't know, to education and or just establishing a parallel system. Most of us sitting here today have their own gardens, work the soil, do it in a different way, not use herbicides, not use pesticides, replenish the soil with natural substances. And I like what Jim has said in the past, some of the chemicals that are put into by big ag into the ground is like crack cocaine. You know, it everything just kind of explodes and grows, but then the nutrient value, that's one thing that's going on, but it kills the soil. And then you have to move on and put more chemicals and more chemical fertilizers in the soil. And it just keeps compounding until the systems are depleted, until it's contaminated. And so we're saying there's a different way to do things. That is the hopeful part, that there is a different way to do things. So why don't we, I would like to move into, okay, so this shift in thinking needs to happen. And I'd like to move into the notion of community and resilience, or however we want to approach that. And I thought I would like to begin, because we're going to take a break in about 7 or 8 minutes, but what I'd like to do is kind of have you talk a little bit about what that word means to you, community. And that's also tied to the concept of an eco-village or living in an intentional community. But there's also the notion of what is community. So would anyone like to, do you want me to continue talking about community, or would you like to say something?
I'd say that I kind of defined it as folks assisting one another in an honest attempt to create a better way of life for all in their sphere of most direct influence. This effort may have a ripple effect with all people.
Yeah, I mean, decisions are made by communities locally. Then they're going to have an attitude, an eye to those things that are going to promote the growth of their children and their grandchildren. So they're not going to pollute the stream. They're not going to do the things that lead to moving on. Like industry has no conscience. It just simply extracts and moves on. And so there is this, for me, the most important thing about community is a resilience through cooperation and through being responsible for the land, for each other, in such a way that in itself is going to be a self-correcting factor. We're going to notice when the stream gets polluted and the cows start dying and things start happening. Now, the industry doesn't notice that. They just move on. So we have huge dead zones in the ocean from bad farming methods. And that's just one of the many problems we have because we aren't treating it that way. So again, the ecological consciousness, the sense that everything is connected to everything else and everybody is connected to everyone else, that is fostered by community. Small groups of people. By the way, small groups of people and community is the only really way we can practice democracy.
Okay. Good points. And Randy?
To me, community is people working on common goals for a collective best interest. And so it could be local, and it's going to have to be global also. We have a global community. And we have the internet. We have total access to information, communications, and we do have the ability to make quick changes in our local lives and in our global lives, and totally change our relationship with energy.
Yes, and so right now we are sitting in a radio station in Round Mountain, the community of Round Mountain. Randy, about how many people live in Round Mountain, do you think?
I think the sign down there says 200.
Okay.
But I don't know how close that is, because it'd be hard to define where the edge of the community are at. To me, it kind of goes in about a 10-mile radius.
Okay. And so obviously this is a smaller community, and the other three of us come up from Reading. And I think the sign says 89,000 within Reading, or I'm not sure whether that's part of Shasta County or the city limits. So
that's city limits.
That's city limits, the 89,000. So that is a large community, mm-hmm. okay? And that makes a difference too. So we have these smaller ones where I think that we do know each other more and we know the people within the community, and then larger communities where we become very individualized at times within those, except maybe having small pockets of community. And when I was thinking about community, I did a little bit of research, and I was looking for other definitions as well to see, and we're all touching on basically what community is, and some other aspects of it that I was looking at are identify with one another, share common interests, collectively identify problems, which has been mentioned, and resilience to climate change. And that brings us into resilience. And we were going to be talking a little bit about self-reliance in the second half of this show. But one thing that's fascinating to me about resilience, when I was looking and reading about it, was that the community or the ecological system has to have the capacity to adapt in terms of climate change. And that is really interesting, because there are going to be these temperature shifts, hurricanes, cyclones, floods, droughts. And so an idea is resilience to help improve communities' capability to live with uncertainty. Now, I don't like that at all, because I like things, you know, that are certain. I shouldn't say that, because we face changes all the time. But the idea that it's uncertain, there may be a spring, there may be a summer, it may be really hot, it may be a huge storm. So this and learning new skills. And so, Craig, what were you going to say about that?
Well, the idea of community. Yeah. KKRN is an example of here in Round Mountain, of all places, with a population of, quote, 200. the sense of community was enough to create this radio station.
Yes.
Now, that is really a prime example of community. And we call ourselves community radio, and in fact, we are. So there's an example of what just a small community can do, and we're using our energies to try to focus on these kind of problems. So yay for community radio.
That is true, and I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I got so involved in our discussion that I didn't remind our listeners that this is KKRN, community mm-hmm. radio, and we rely on the community and volunteers to make these shows possible. So thank you for reminding us of that too, Craig, because there is this KKRN community. Now, I just want to say a couple more points here, and we're going to take a break. But as I was reading resilience, because I want to be resilient, I want to have an environment that's resilient. Another aspect of it is the capacity of a system to absorb disturbances. Okay, mm-hmm. The infrastructure in terms of housing, transportation, power, sanitation, the ability to repair and renovate these systems within community. And so there's Puerto Rico right now, right, that is just suffering greatly, and other parts of the United States has suffered as well. But the idea that if we were living in a small community, let's just say that in Round Mountain, let's say where we're all living here, and some of us had different skills. So does this mean that if something happens with power or sanitation, there would be people within that community that could help repair and renovate these systems, so that we need people that can fix things as well? It's not all sitting in front of computers and plugging in stuff on computers. It's the ability to go out and repair when things happen, especially with climate change, when storms knock out systems, and that is happening. And they knock down internet services and phone services.
Once again, we're talking about a definition of resilience and community has to do with ecological principles, and the number one rule in an ecosystem is diversity is strength. The more diverse, the more we have that going on,
yes,
the more strength and resilience we have to adapt to whatever comes along.
Yes.
That's both measured by types of people, different ideas, as well as an ecological nature level, we're talking about how many kinds of plants and how many kinds of animals, because they all cooperate together. And if we don't have cooperation, like our bodies cooperate. The cells in our body aren't all on their own page. They're cooperating together. And when we don't have cooperation, we get breakdowns in the system. And what happens? We have disease. We have illness. And then it snowballs.
And I do want to say this again, because, and I say this as often as I can, where I live on 5 acres, there are a lot of rodents, ground squirrels and so forth, gophers, moles, and et cetera. But people love to kill coyotes and snakes, and in other areas they want to kill wolves, and it just makes me cringe, because all of these species come together in this web of life to help keep the balance. If we had more snakes, we would have fewer gophers and moles. If we had more coyotes, we would have fewer rodents. And these become a real problem when you're trying to grow food, when things get out of balance. It's very, very difficult. And so we're going to be taking a break very shortly. And when we come back, we're going to talk about intentional communities, 3 larger ones, and then we're going to talk about among ourselves what that might look like if we wanted to live more in community. So we're going to play a little bit of music here, and we'll be right back. And this is KKRN Community Radio.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we. As we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years, when we will have about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere. Will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. So much and waste so much, how much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? A little pollution is so thick and dark and dense, it contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend.
Welcome back to KKRN Community Radio. I'm Pamela Spoto, host of Dig This Environmental Watch, and we're talking about community, eco-villages, self-reliance, a change of consciousness, food security. And so in the first half, we primarily focused on what does it mean, what does community mean to us, and what kind of change of consciousness might we need in order to proceed with necessary changes. And I think I would like to say, because I keep forgetting to do this, the music that you just heard is from Bob Wickline, and it's called Let's Take Our Heads Out of the Sand. And I play this on just about every Dig This show because I really like that.
Me too.
Okay,
yeah,
so thank you, Bob Wickline, for this great song, because it's true, we need to wake up, wake up.
Pull our heads out of the sand.
That is really, really true. So during our short break, we were talking a little bit about, you know, in terms of solutions, and I suppose this is one way to proceed here is with the notion of intentional communities as one possibility. And when I attended a conference and sometimes presented this conference at California State University, Chico, 2 years ago, there were several people talking about eco-villages. And so I want to share with you some ideas, just very briefly, and then we're going to talk about our concept of what this might look like. The first one is called Dancing Rabbit, because I want to get a sense of what are other people doing in order to come together and try to lead a simpler, cleaner life. And I say simpler now. Some people will say, you know, we can really, and I was listening to two scientists talk, we can really make changes without making any changes. You know what I'm saying? We don't have to change anything in our life to stop climate change. And I'm going, well, how does that work? You know?
I don't understand.
So,
how did they explain it?
Well, that maybe we'd only need a 5% change in terms of carbon reduction, but that doesn't mean that we couldn't drive, we couldn't eat the same way, we couldn't do all those things that we normally do. And I just don't buy that.
That's insanity.
Well, see, a lot of people, though, will respond to, I don't want to make any changes. I like my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Now, our lifestyle is also predicated on taking resources from worldwide places and wars and so forth. So we might want to, that might be part of the paradigm shift that we're talking about. So this one intentional village is called Dancing Rabbit in northeast Missouri, and their goal is to live more simply, live with people who share your values, and they have about 50 members, but they would like to create a small town with 500 to 1,000 members committed to radical environmental sustainability, and they have over 300 acres. And another one, Earth Haven in North Carolina, near Asheville, has about 300 acres, and their mission is to care for people and the earth. But on their homepage, they said they are seeking, quote, emotionally mature people.
Well, that leaves out our president.
Oh. I think also part of this is you have to put energy in. And before I get to the next one, that some of these intentional communities are saying, maybe this is what this emotional maturity means. Some of them are saying, okay, you have to commit to 42 hours of work a week. And I find that fascinating. So what does that mean? That means, well, there would be babysitting, there's bike repair, there's an economy that's going on, there's growing your own food, an economy in the sense that you might be making things to sell. And so everybody is working together, and all those funds come together and are distributed within the community. So they really want people who are serious about this lifestyle. And they also have natural building from straw and mud. And then Twin Oaks in Central Virginia has been developing for 30 years. It has a huge farm. They have a large house with various bedrooms, but then they also have individual houses, and they grow 75% of their own food. And their economy or their business within the community is tofu and hammocks, making tofu and hammocks. And I was watching a short video on a guy who said he used to work for a business making bike repairs, and he didn't really like that. But now that's what he does within the community. And he has a little shop there, and they have these paths, and people bike from place to place, you know, around the hundreds of acres. So those are just three, and those are in the Midwest or the East Coast. And then I think I saw one online that was in Nevada City, but you had to plop down $100,000 to be part of this more. It was like, it wasn't mud and straw houses. And I want to say mud and straw houses, when you look at Earthships, they're very, very beautiful. It's not like just living in caves or something. Because some people go, well, I don't want to live, go back to living in a cave. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about using less energy. We're talking about maybe not having to have heat and cooling because you have really good insulation.
Like the straw house in Trinity County. I mean, that's the straw house. The
straw bale house.
Yeah, but it's made out of straw.
Mm-hmm,
It's very efficient.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Randy, you had mentioned something earlier about what were you saying about some of these eco-villages that you said that you had been doing a little bit of research on these too?
Well, I was kind of surprised to discover that there are some that are way priced out of the range where I am at. I'm contacting them for basic information, but they're set up as a business in a way to sell off parcels or to sell schooling.
Yes.
And you can't really get the information that I'm seeking. Because they're at some other commercial level, and I have nothing against that, but I would like to find eco villages and communities that are willing to share openly for our mutual benefit in the future of our planet.
That's a great point, Randy. I mean, to share for the mutual benefit of the planet. Yes.
Chris. I was just thinking of Elon Musk again. He was giving out the knowledge about his Tesla cars and the. All that he had learned, and he said, for free. Now, all these others are very proprietary.
Yes.
And GM and so on. They won't do that. And he said, hey, we're all in it together, and I want to have this expand and grow and make the Earth a better place, so I'm giving it out. Well, that's an idea that is unlike what Randy's talking about with these intentional communities who are jealously hoarding it like, the capitalist that they sound like they are.
Well, again, I think we're talking about a change of consciousness here. Until we change our way of thinking and we begin to realize the folly of our ways, there's not a lot of incentive to do something totally outside the lines of what we've been doing. And what Randy's talking about and what we all have been talking about all along is something that involves that shift, that movement from competition to cooperation. So we're all on the same page working together. And so we're not finding a lot of communities that are living that model. Many of them are trying to fit. They want to have their own little space and they want to do certain things, but they're trying to fit within the framework of what has been provided before us. And that's simply folly. It won't work. So if we're going to do this, we have to first shift the way we're thinking, which is going to lead us to new ideas and new ways of approaching it. So these communities you're talking about are really, they're thinking about working in cooperation with each other, not about being a corporation.
Yes, yes. Yes, Randy.
In my discussions and debates with people about environmentalism, I don't know how many times I've been confronted with, what do you want to go back to the cave?
Yes.
And I think with the technology and knowledge that we have today, I think it would be a good idea. How great would it be to just return to the earth and get within our energy means and just settle down and get to know each other?
That sounds refreshing.
I'm speechless. Yeah. Yes. Yes, that is true. And as we are sitting here, someone is ringing, but that's okay. We're going to continue on here. And with the idea of these communities, with smaller communities, let's talk a little bit about self-reliance and food security. Jim, I guess what I would like to say, and I'm going to call on Jim and then Craig and Randy, is that I do want to be healthy, and I'm trying to live a healthy lifestyle. And I was just watching a news show yesterday and the commentators were saying the research is showing that Americans are, as they get older, are becoming less healthy. They're having cognitive problems, and they're also having physical problems. And they even mentioned about, because they were saying that the retirement age, and Medicare age moving from 65 to 67, and people are working longer and so on and so forth. But some people were having trouble getting out of bed and walking across the room. Now, And that is really unfortunate. I want to stay as healthy as I can. And part of that has to do with being self-reliant. I want to be able to go out and work in the garden. This also helps us with obesity, for example. Not only, I mean, the physical exercise of it all, but I think another reason that I think we are becoming a little bit fatter is because of the sedentary lifestyle of being in front of computers all day. And even children, they're not running around climbing trees, going to tree houses, whatever the case is. They're playing video games. But that put aside, being self-reliant means that I'm healthy as possible. I'm trying to grow my own food. I'm cooking from scratch. I mean, that's what it means to me, and it does take time. It does take time to do that. So, Jim, what would you like to say about that?
I think that the problem with health degeneration is another symptom of the folly of the way we've been doing things. So the buildup of toxicity from many vectors, as well as the way we're destroying our soil, so our food density is becoming impaired. And so there's so many ways we're being exposed to things that aren't good for us. Not good for the environment, not good for us, because we're dependent on the environment and it's dependent on us, and it's a cooperative endeavor. If we don't begin to be cooperative in our thinking and the way we approach things, we're just going to kill ourselves off, because the ramifications of the direction we're going is more and more of that kind of thing. There's kind of a growing, people talk about the dumbing down. Well, there's a growing inability of people to reason, for pattern recognition, to understand the role that they have with respect to one another in the environment and a number of different levels. And so I see the health thing as being, the health degradation as being just another symptom of it. One of the most troubling symptoms, because if people are, as we become more impaired, we're less able to reason, we're less able to solve these problems, and we become more stuck in our ways. And we continue to, and this is a situation where we are continuing to do the wrong thing, but just double down on it.
Yes, and I want to interject just one thing here, because I know that a friend of mine was talking about this summer in terms of wanting to raise their own food and not getting tomatoes and so forth. I want to bring this back to climate change for just a moment too. Is that in Reading it was 117 degrees this summer? I don't know how many days was it, like a 60 to 90 days of over 100 degree weather, and what happens? And, of course, Jim can talk more about this, too, is that the flowers abort, the flowers don't produce. And so what's going to happen, and is as time goes on and it gets hotter and harder, we are in the midst of climate change. The past years, every year has gotten hotter and hotter and hotter. So that's another thing that we're going to have to deal with in terms of facing food and food security and our health, to have a healthy brain, to have a healthy body. So, Craig, were you going to say something about this in terms of...
Just that I noticed that this year it wasn't possible to even grow tomatoes well at all. It was so hot, consistently hot, that they just didn't want to do anything. And I'm just finding that out.
Right, and so that could mean... possibly, and I'm going to ask Randy about this and Jim too. I mean, there's the idea, and this makes it even more complicated. You have a greenhouse. You have to cool the greenhouse. You grow vegetables within the greenhouse, because we aren't taking action against climate change, but we're in terms of stopping those greenhouse gases. But that may be what we're faced with. And then if we do start trying to cool greenhouses, where is that power going to come from? Is it going to come from passive, passive solar? I don't know.
Well, like greenhouses, there are various ways that you can cool a greenhouse by design. It is one way, but then like power, you can't have solar power to create fans. As far as like cooling systems like air conditioning or something, I don't see that happening. Just gonna have to totally redesign the way our architecture is for living and for growing vegetables, and that's built in if you believe science.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And Jim, did you want to comment on that in terms of, there are different ways that we can approach this if we're talking about community and self-reliance and food security. And, you know, one thing might be communal gardens. And I'm not talking about neighborhood gardens. I mean, that's wonderful, too. But if you have, you know, four or five people, three or four people living within a certain area, maybe you do have a garden that everybody goes out and works in should they want to do that. But that also takes into account for what happens if somebody knows more about gardening than another person. I mean, do we all kind of share equally, or do people listen to other people? And then with that goes back to cooperation.
Absolutely. We have to learn how to get along together. We have to learn how to make it work. We have to learn how to, you know, to listen to the people who know what they're talking about. And everybody's got something to offer. And so, you know, that's part of the whole thing of resiliency, diversity, coming together.
Yes.
And unless we begin to think differently, once again, I sound like a broken record here. Well, I am a broken record. You know, until we change our values, we're going to continue to do the same thing over and over and over and over again. And this is going to be one of the biggest challenges in dealing with climate change and dealing with the heat abatement. Just that one little factor, as well as water, is we're going to have to do things differently. Randy talked about infrastructure and how we build and how we do things like that, getting down into the earth so we take advantage of insulation qualities and things like that, how we shade our plants, how we develop diversity so we have microsystems. One of the things in our garden is we have diversity, and we have trees, we have different ecosystems. So we have a range from hot when it's the middle of the summer to, you know, 50 degrees underneath some plants in places where it's cooler and the wind's flowing through it a little differently. We have to begin to work with the natural system in ways that how nature does that. You know, and there are places, for example, down along the borders of Arizona, where it borders the Sonoran Desert in Mexico, and where the farmers and native people have been doing all kinds of things for years because they've always had a heat problem down there. And it's not as bad as we're getting now, but they figured out ways to do things. We need to listen to those folks. We need to listen to the farmers in sub-Saharan Africa who figured this out. And they've been working with it for a long time, and they figured out how to store water, how to reduce water costs. Netherlands is breaking ground with how to reduce their water usage up to 90% of conventional farming, and they're just booming with organic agriculture.
And all of that is really wonderful. And this is why I had Vandana Shiva as one of the books here, because she talks about where in India, and she's a physicist, she's a scientist, and she's wonderful, and she's also an environmental activist, that the people themselves have acclimated seeds to the area. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you have the multinational corporations coming in and saying, use our seed, and then you're going to use our herbicides, and you're going to use our pesticides, and the land is destroyed. So we have to keep that into perspective. That we need to acclimate seeds. We need to be able to work without using toxins that are going to poison us. And Randy and some of us have been talking about too is, I wanted to ask you, Randy, you know, in terms of a small community where there might be a communal garden, where there might be some trading going on, some people are really good at making oils, let's say cooking oils, somebody else is really good at making something else. I mean, all of this is labor intensive. This is not, is it labor intensive? It takes time. And that is what one thing that our culture seems to not have. It's busy, 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 busy. I got to answer that email. I got to do that tweet. I got to message that person. Well, what about growing some food? You know, that might be a really healthy thing to do. Randy, what do you think?
Well, I think that that is kind of a no-brainer. There's two things that we need to survive on this planet. Basically, the most basic elements is food and shelter. And so we have to totally redesign our relationship with our environment. You know, instead of having giant houses that are built out of sticks, we can, you know, we have to go smaller houses that are more energy efficient. We have to really concentrate on reducing our consumption in all areas, because it's totally unsustainable.
Absolutely.
The Shoshone, they say, worked an average of 2 hours a day to feed themselves. That's in an intact biosphere. Now people are working 40 or 80 hours a week. And they're falling behind. They're buried in debt.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true. Now, we only have maybe a minute and a half left. Would anybody like to make some concluding statements? I see this as an exciting possibilities. You know, this is not right at the moment. This is not distressing. Oh, my goodness, the world is collapsing. A lot of systems are collapsing. We're losing a lot of species a day. But what can I do now to do my part? And I do want to be more in community, be as healthy as I can, grow my own food, and know how to do that. Would anybody else like to say something in closing?
Well, myself, I'm very encouraged by what I see when I really search for the way that there are people around the globe who are working to address all these challenges that we have going. They're designing technologies, they're designing housing, methods, community. They're solving all these problems. Mm-hmm. That information is there. All we have to do is seek it out and start trying to apply it to our own lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the ways of indigenous populations have been dealing with environmental stressors for a long time and figured out ways to do it. So the Shoshone is a good example of that.
Yes.
Some of that requires that we have intact ecosystems, so restoration is a big deal. But we have both technology on the one hand, which is the modern scientific and moving, and then we have old ways that we need to resurrect.
And we are out of time, and I would like to thank our listening audience, and this is KKRN.org Community Radio. I'd like to thank Dr. Jim Collins, Craig Boyer, MSW. I'd like to thank Randy Compton for all of his expertise in research on climate change. I'm Pamela Spoto. Please tune in next Saturday, well, a week from now, for Dig This, Trump Watch. Thank you very much.